Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Respiratory. This podcast aims to bring you expert perspectives from a multidisciplinary team on the management of rare and unusual neuroendocrine tumours, also known as NETs. Specialists in the MDT involved in caring for patients with NETs discuss individual patient cases to highlight new and emerging approaches to diagnosis and treatment, and the impact of effective multidisciplinary teamwork and coordination on patient care. This activity is funded by an independent medical education grant from Advanced Accelerator Applications and is jointly provided by USF Health and Touch IME. In this podcast, a medical oncologist, a nuclear medicine specialist, and a nurse specialist discuss the case of a patient with a liver-dominant NET of unknown primary origin and the importance of managing patient expectations regarding long-term treatment and adverse event management.
Hello, my name is Diane Reedy Lagunes, and I am a medical oncologist and associate deputy physician in chief at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City and in the U.S. I'm joined today by my colleague and friend, Dr. Thomas Hope, nuclear medicine physician and director of molecular therapy at UCSF in San Francisco, also here in the U.S., as well as Ms. Catherine Bouvier Ellis, an expert in the field of neuroendocrine tumor nursing and founder as well as CEO of Neuroendocrine Cancer in the U.K. in Lymington Spa. In this section, we will be considering the question, supporting treatment adherence, what strategies are needed for safety management, focusing particularly on liver-predominant disease? And so I'd like to start with a case of a 53-year-old gentleman who unfortunately had symptoms for several years, eventually led to fatigue and some weight loss, and after several visits to several doctors, eventually got diagnosed with liver disease, several tumors, biopsy proven to be a well-differentiated neuroendocrine tumor with a Ka67 of about 5 to 10%, so considered intermediate grade, and was found to have a functional tumor, meaning hormone secreting. The patient did receive several therapies. This first image here does show that there's a predominant tumor here. So I'd like to start with Tom as the radiologist on our group. Tom, when there's liver-predominant disease, obviously in a specialty center like UCSF, there's no one right answer here, right? But how do you approach this? A patient with hormone-secreting tumors has a lot of symptoms, starting to lose some weight. What's the best approach on what we know would be the best therapy to start with?
That's a great question, Diane. And I think when someone's having hormonal-related symptoms, the focus here should be to try to control hormonal secretion. And the best treatment to limit hormonal secretion in this patient would be liver-directed therapy. Liver-directed therapy is fast, causes tumor necrosis quickly, and would be the fastest treatment to decrease hormone secretion. So, you know, there's three major modalities for liver-directed therapy, which would be bland embolization, chemoembolization, radioembolization. We as a field are sort of moving away from radioembolization, obviously, due to the risks of radiation-induced liver disease. And so really the debate is between chemo and bland embolization. And obviously, there's the RETNET trial, which is currently about to be completed enrollment, which should hopefully answer the question about whether or not bland or chemoembolization is preferred in this patient. And obviously, in this image, you're showing a solitary lesion with preserved liver. This looks like potentially a good patient for a selective embolization procedure to help control the patient's symptoms, whereas PRT would be reserved for someone who has more systemic disease. And really, the goal with PRT is more so for prevention of progression rather than decrease in hormonal secretion.
I think that's a great point. And Kathy, as you know, many of our patients, none of these therapies are free without any side effects, right? So for the functional patient or patients with have hormone secreting symptoms, getting that hormone level down, as Tom said, is critically important. But for the non-functional patient that's quite asymptomatic, it could be tricky sometimes because anything that we're about to do is going to impose symptoms. So when you have patients, even for example, on somatostatin analogs, I would imagine they do have some symptoms. Can you talk to us about the sort of side effects that your patients may develop and what you often will try to address for them?
Yeah, I mean, of course, no treatment comes without side effect. And I think, you know, we have some work to do to understand, I think, some of the long-term consequences of all the treatments. This poor chap has been living with this disease and has had multiple treatments over the last 15 years. So I imagine, you know, for him, before even discussing what the next treatment option might be, we'd really just try and understand kind of where he's at, because this will certainly feel like a re-diagnosis or a new diagnosis for him. And that can have quite a psychological impact. But, you know, even, you know, we talk about SSAs and them being, you know, often the first treatment of choice, certainly for our hormonal patients. But, you know, they come with many side effects themselves, from, you know, the risk of gallstones to nausea to bloating, etc. But in fact, you know, one of the top side effects that we see out of our community here in the UK when we did a study a couple of years ago was actually constipation. It was also the burden of the disease, hair thinning. There was a whole list of side effects that they expressed, which weren't actually probably in the original trials that were done. It was more around their lived experience. So, you know, I think what's really important is that before any treatment is started, that a patient has a full and open conversation about the reality of those treatments, and that, you know, anything that they think is potentially a side effect, to know those red flag symptoms, to know when they can call their team. We need to provide self-management tools. You know, these patients are at home managing these symptoms the majority of the time. You know, can they access their team? Do they have access to a specialist team? Do they have access to a specialist nurse? Which is why it's so important, obviously, to have an expert centre looking after these patients, even just to get those sort of facilities available to them, but also learning from others, you know, others with that lived experience, you know, local advocacy organisations or national ones that can really support them. And I think just validating and understanding the symptoms that they're expressing, even if they may not be exactly treatment related, it is also very important, because they're having an impact on their quality of life.
Yeah, I think that's so critically important. And, you know, because we don't have what we call sequencing studies to tell us for sure what is the best therapy to do in the first, second, or third line settings, we often need to discuss with the patient what's right for them. And you talk about financial toxicities and other quality of life measures. I mean, some oral drugs, at least in the United States, can be incredibly expensive for patients. So we have to be very mindful of that. And I think you're absolutely right. And listening to the patient and really taking a deep dive into what symptoms they may have, because we may say, well, it's non-functional and they're asymptomatic. But when you actually ask the question, as you said, you'll hear something different. I often tell my patients, you know, grade one fatigue every single day is a big deal, as opposed to sometimes, you know, an acute treatment that, you know, you could recover from and then not have symptoms from. So I think these types of decisions are critically important in terms of knowing your patient, their own health issues, and what would be best for that patient. I wanted to share, this patient actually has been living with this disease for 15 years, and is often the case, 15 years later, the patient's liver-predominant disease was actually controlled for a while, but now clearly based on the PET imaging that we have here, which is a PET dotatate, has evidence of extrahepatic disease and growth. In terms of the safety and side effect profiles, often when patients progress on somatostatin analogs, the next line therapy is PRRT. Tom, in terms of side effects there, anything you want to share in terms of the safety of that, since you're the one administering that drug?
Yeah, PRRT side effects, I sort of think of them in two big categories. One is sort of how you feel afterwards, and the second is sort of the long-term injury due to the radiation. Right. So after PRRT, patients feel tired, lethargic, loss of appetite, low-grade nausea, things like that. And that usually resolves in about a week or so. Some patients, it can take up to 5 to 6 weeks for that sort of low-grade ennui to resolve. And then the longer-term side effects are kidney injury, bone marrow injury. I actually talk a lot about liver injury, because I think about the liver, particularly in a patient like this who's been heavily pretreated, you can actually start to develop background radiation-induced liver injury. It's not commonly described or understood, but I also think about that. And then, you know, to what Catherine was mentioning, hair loss is actually a common thing that people do describe. And there's a number of other symptoms that people struggle with treatment. But overall, it's relatively well tolerated.
And in terms of the PRRT that we have now, based on NETTER-1, obviously this patient would be a candidate for lutetium 177 dotatate. But any other trials on the horizon for PRRT for a patient with now extrahepatic disease that is progressing?
Yeah, so there's a couple of randomized studies out there. There's the lutetium dotatoc or etetriotide studies, the control and compete trial, comparing either lutetium dotatoc to everolimus or lutetium dotatoc to chemotherapy and other treatments in higher grade cancers. So that will be actually the first randomized studies with PRRT in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, which will be incredibly valuable. And the thing I do want to highlight in those trials, which people aren't fully aware of, is the company that's running those is actually doing post-treatment dosimetry after every single cycle and every patient received lutetium dotatoc, which will be incredibly valuable and provide us a lot of information to understand how much dose do patients need and the relationship between uptake dose and response. And so I think there'll be a lot of great data that comes out of that study to help us really understand how to treat these PNET patients properly with PRRT.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And because Kathy alluded to before, the quality of life is so incredibly important, and having prospective data to understand the toxicities, the grade levels of those in a prospective fashion, and to understand the differences of that could be very often incredibly helpful to know which therapy at least we should consider first line versus second line, et cetera. So more to come. Tom and Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on this topic at www.touchrespiratory.com. Don't forget, there are 3 other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team.